Pacifica Radio.
Escuchando in Washington and all points beyond. This is Oscar Fernandez, and you're listening to Latino Media Collective here on WPFW 89.3 FM, Washington. In Distrito Colombia, here on this Friday, March 14th, 2025. We're also heard on latinomediacollective.com. You can find us on Twitter under the name at LMC underscore show. That is at LMC underscore show. And of course, live on WPFWFM.org. That's WPFWFM.org. Once again, this is Oscar Fernandez, and today on the show, we put the spotlight on both El Salvador and Palestine by discussing the extraordinary life and political legacy of the late Shafiq Handal, the former Salvadoran politician and FMLN leader of Palestinian descent, and how he forged solidarity with the Middle East and El Salvador during the turbulent 1980s. And to discuss this, joining us for the first time on the show is Amy Fayas. She is a Salvadoran Costa Rican writer, editor, and historian. She is also an assistant editor at the Arab Studies Journal and a PhD candidate in history at the University of California in Santa Barbara. Her December article in NACLA is entitled Brothers in the Resistance. And if you hear any hustle and bustle of the streets in the background while we had this conversation, Amy Fayas is joining us from Beirut, Lebanon, as we record this conversation. So, Amy Fayas, welcome to the show.
Thank you so much. I'm so excited to be in conversation about this piece and with you.
Yes, and allow me to pull back the curtain and tell you something that I told you before we started recording here, that one of my first reports that I did for WPFW back in 2004, when I was still a volunteer and an intern, was on the 2004 elections in El Salvador, which featured Shafiq Handal. So in a lot of ways, this is a full circle moment for me to finally see an article in English that goes in depth into the legacy of Shafiq Handal. So, Amy, right now we are living in a time where the U.S. government and previous administrations have made Salvadorans synonymous with gangs and Palestinians synonymous with terrorists. And while most of the public recognizes both the fallacy and inherent bigotry of such ideas, Articles like yours shows that such stereotypes are neither new nor original. So let's start with two questions here. What compelled you to write this article on the late Shafiq Handel, which a lot of people listening to us may not know who he is? And that sort of leads us to the million-dollar question here. Who was Shafiq Handel?
Thank you so much for both of these questions. And both of these are very personal to me. So I'll just begin with saying, I was not as familiar with Shafiq Handel, even though I have many family members who were part of the leftist resistance in El Salvador and part of the diaspora who continued those connections. But I started my work on the history of the modern Middle East veering into the Palestinian diaspora in El Salvador, which is per capita the largest Palestinian diaspora outside of the Middle East. So that's very significant. And we know many leaders, obviously, no secret that the current president come dictator has those ties. But then I came across Shafiq Handel over and over again. And what ended up happening and the origin of this piece was actually that I was living in Lebanon. I had moved to Lebanon in 2023, and I'm Salvadoreña, and I'm in the Middle East. And I learned that there was another Salvadoreño who came to Lebanon. And we both had similar circumstances. So I had moved a few months before October 7th, 2023, which is obviously when the events that unfolded in Gaza began. And so Lebanon suddenly became part of this theater of war due to many different reasons. But then I started, as I was continuing my research, finding that Shafiq Handel came to Lebanon in 1981 during a time where there was civil war in Lebanon and there was civil war in El Salvador. And this was a moment for not only him to build networks of solidarity, but to also find common causes in both of these very different places, but they realized that they had sort of common enemies. And so I began to dig and dig in the archives here and in a lot of Salvadoran archives that I had consulted to uncover, you know, how did he come here? Why did he come here? And then, you know, I started to look into his family history and his connection to the region. So here I will delve into, well, who is he, right? And maybe what he was doing in the region, besides pointing out these common enemies and common struggles. So Shafiq Handel, to many, is synonymous with the leftist movement in 20th century El Salvador. And he has a very interesting history because, as you mentioned, he was born to Palestinian migrants from Bethlehem who settled in Usulután, which is in southeastern El Salvador. He was born in 1930. And from a very young age, he was very politically involved. His family papers demonstrate that he was active as young as 14 years old, which is when there was a mass uprising against the dictatorship at the time in El Salvador. And so if you think about that, you know, what must have animated this very young person to think about systemic oppression, to think about struggles for liberation, and particularly in a leftist persuasion. And I followed him through his college years, which is what ultimately got him exiled from El Salvador twice. He was very involved with the Communist Party, with revolutionary students at the Universidad de El Salvador. And so it is in his time as an intellectual, not just someone who is caring about workers' rights, who has this background where his parents probably experienced in his community marginalization because he was of Palestinian descent. But he ends up rising through the ranks and becomes the secretary general of the Communist Party of El Salvador. And from that moment on, he rises through the ranks, or rather, he joins the party in 1950 and then becomes secretary general in 1973. So what we see is that he is one of these founding figures. He's, you know, one of the primary individuals that is associated particularly with the Communist Party, but various different strands of, I would say, leftist thought, socialist ideas, thinking about the marginalized in El Salvador, los campesinos, and other marginalized individuals, such as Chinese and Palestinian workers.
Fantastic. This ties into a lot of things that we've discussed with regards to the Palestinian diaspora in Latin America. As a matter of fact, we did a show several years ago dedicated to the Palestinian diaspora in Latin America, from El Salvador all the way down to Chile. And people could go to latinomediacollector.com to listen to that episode. And as recently as last December, NACLA did a whole magazine dedicated to Latin American resistance and solidarity with the people of Gaza. And we had the pleasure of speaking with one of the editors, Georgie Garza, to discuss this movement in Latin America. And I think your article was featured as well among several others in that version of NACLA's most recent report. So going back to what you just mentioned with regards to institutional racism and xenophobia, can you speak a little bit more about how institutionalized that was in El Salvador in the 1930s? Because it wasn't just Palestinians as well. It also explains a lot as to why there's little to no visible Afro-Latino community in El Salvador. So let's go back to that time period to sort of expand on how expansive this institutional xenophobia was during that time. Because reading your article, it sort of leads me to believe that this is one of the main things that compelled Shafiq Handel into political life, correct?
Exactly. These are all very salient points, particularly we're dealing with a time period in the 1930s where El Salvador is undergoing a period of significant social, political, and economic upheaval. And the state policies, particularly under the dictatorship of Maximiliano Martinez, really targeted and scapegoated very specific communities, whether it was the indigenous community, whether it was the Afro-Salvadoran community that you mentioned, and also what they called pernicious foreigners. This would include immigrants from China, but particularly migrants from the Middle East. And there have been various different suggestions as to why this might have been. And the overwhelming interpretation is that the Middle Eastern community, whether they were Syrian, Palestinian, Lebanese, were traders. They were commercemen and so had a lot of very successful businesses. And this is reflected in what I would consider part of this institutional xenophobia. Into the mid-1930s, you have a series of laws restricting what members of these communities can do. And in fact, the Palestinian Salvadoran community are required to register yearly with a newly created Ministry of Migration. And I've seen a lot of these documents, and what's so interesting about them, and also horrifying, because I think we can see similar threads, not only in our time, but in various times in US and Salvadoran history, but they're required to actually prove that they can speak Spanish, that they can write Spanish. They have to write down the names of Salvadoreños that can vouch for them. And even when they do all of this, they're not allowed to be business owners. They're not allowed to establish any new business ventures. They're very limited in their economic activities. And so this legal paper trail suggests that they were very specifically targeted because of their business ventures. And a lot of what I've seen in terms of circulars in the newspapers are demonizing this community as people who are exploiting Salvadoran goodwill. And it ties really into what the dictatorship is trying to do in this period, which at the time is also very fascist. So they are specifically targeting these communities that they see also as allying themselves with other marginalized communities, whether, again, as I mentioned earlier, indigenous, Afro-Salvadoreño, or other migrants. And of course, and I know that you've talked about this on the show before, so I won't go into it too much, but you know, we have La Matanza, which is this horrible incident, right, of wide-scale repression. And this is all connected. And so this is a very important and pivotal time, which I think, you know, again, we don't have this document from Shafiq Handel that says, I got into politics because of this moment. But given his involvement around all of these issues and given his own background, I would assume that this is very structural. And this is also a result of this, you know, horrific period of the dictatorship.
It is a horrific period in Salvadoran history because the laws that were set in place during that time, while most of it, if not all of it, has been abolished since then, it really explains why El Salvador, probably more than any other country in Latin America, has a general population that is profoundly disconnected from its indigenous roots, from its Afro-descendant roots, and in some cases, their Arab roots as well. And so that's the legacy of that fascist time period that you mentioned as well, because we did a whole show on La Matanza as well with Professor Jorge Cuellar, which is fantastic. I encourage everyone to listen to it because that sort of sets the chain of events that we've seen in El Salvador almost a century since. Now, based on your research, could you tell us about the parallels between the common threats faced by both El Salvador and Palestine during this time period that may have compelled Handel to develop such relations with Middle Eastern resistance? And I guess with this question, it sort of, you know, addresses the elephant in the room here. And as a matter of fact, I'll quote you from your article in which you mentioned, quote, Handel stressed that these two regions had a common threat, the alliance of U.S. and Israeli arms, funds, and military training, end quote. So your response here.
Absolutely. There's a lot of interpretations of how the Middle East and Latin America come together, what those ties are. And I consider this one of the many heightened episodes of greater collaboration between these two regions, which has been going on since the 19th century. But in this moment, you have a very unique, what I would consider, intersection of various violent factors that bring these revolutionaries together in what I would consider as well a moment of desperation. Something that I was very interested by is that Shafiq Handel comes to Lebanon in 1981. Why not earlier? Why not later? This is a moment where both the Middle Eastern leftist movement and the leftists in Central America are sort of experiencing some strategic setbacks. And so I think that there, in this moment, there is a greater need to connect with others who are facing similar struggles, and not just similar struggles, but finding themselves victims of similar forces. And in this case, something that comes up so often and people are surprised by is that Israel was very active in Latin America and particularly in Central America under this guise of we're trying to prevent the spread of communism in Latin America. We're trying to prevent the spread of revolutionary ideas in the Western Hemisphere. And, you know, Israel is not in the neighborhood, geographically speaking, but they are funding, providing weapons, training the right, the members of the junta in El Salvador, and actually training them on how to crush counterinsurgencies. And so this violence, I mean, we could even say the orchestration of Oscar Romero's assassination, the person who authorized that was trained by the Israelis. And so you start to see these common links. And I think Shafiq Handel was so unique, and I don't want to exceptionalize him, but he was truly unique in being able to pinpoint what some of those material connections were, right? And then saying, we need to partner with people who have a history of dealing with this U.S.-Israeli alliance in a very tangible way. And he has an in, you know, it's his heritage, but it's not just his heritage, which is what I emphasize in the article. It's these material conditions that really emphasize for him the need to talk to, say, and of course, the main interlocutor at this point is the PLO for him. So the Palestinian Liberation Organization under Yasser Arafat, which is based in Lebanon at the time. So that is why Beirut becomes a meeting point for everyone. And the leftist movement in Lebanon had gone through various periods of popularity, but in this moment was experiencing a lot of setbacks. And so You have Handan coming in, going to Palestinian refugee camps, going and meeting with members of these political parties, thinking and strategizing about how to counter what is an incredibly unequal power relationship between their alliances potentially and US and Israeli alliance, a special relationship. And so what's going on in the Middle East is very much something that Shafiq Handal is paying attention to, and he is directly speaking to in hopes that they can collectively agitate enough to overthrow the influence in their respective countries.
Precisely. And as a matter of fact, I'll take this moment here to point out that we did a whole show last year dedicated to Israel's military involvement in Guatemala back in the 1980s and how their training funding was sort of central to what we saw as the Mayan genocide in the early 80s in Guatemala. And so this gives you an idea that the concept of ethnic cleansing of a particular indigenous group is not unfamiliar territory to Israel, even the current administration in Israel right now. And as a matter of fact, since we mentioned Guatemala and the Mayan genocide, I'm pretty sure that Shafiq Handal and a lot of people in the FMLN were aware of what was going on in neighboring Guatemala, which sort of lends importance and relevance to making these connections with leftist counterparts in places like Palestine and Lebanon during this time period. It's also kind of miraculous that all of this was done without the modern means of communications that we have now with the internet and social media and all these sort of things. So I want to take this moment right now to talk about, you know, the process of documenting this information and putting it into this fantastic article, because I personally wouldn't know where to begin to find all this information. So can you explain your process on how you found this information? You mentioned, I think, that from the family of Shafiq Handal directly, you got some of this information, not to mention this amazing archival photos in your article, which is, for me as a Latin American history nerd, is quite stunning.
Thank you so much for pointing that out. I think, as you pointed out, it was not easy finding this information, but I would start actually by saying, I didn't realize this until I saw a video clip of Shafiq Handal's press conference in Beirut. It was like a 10-second clip that I had found researching a different article about a year and a half ago. And so I said, wait a second. So Shafiq Handal, first of all, did not speak Arabic, which I think is significant in a lot of ways. I think, number one, it points to how, whether we want to call it effective, these xenophobic policies were in El Salvador in preventing migrants from speaking the languages that they immigrated with. But also he needed a translator. And so if you look through all of the photos, you'll also see that in every single public event that he was at, he was there with a translator. So there is this infrastructure that's facilitating his communication with these revolutionaries. And so I went from this video into, I wonder where he appears in the Arabic press. And it was actually the Arabic press that led me to Casa Museo y Instituto Shafiq Handal, which is in El Salvador and which is where all of these documents are housed. Yet they can be accessed online through a website called planetbethlehem.org.
And really?
Yes. So I can send, you know, the link so everyone can see for themselves, because what's it's beautiful. It's really, you have images of his parents in Palestine. You have images of Shafiq Handal when he was born, with his siblings, when he's exiled, with his wife on these tours. And most importantly, during all of these sort of diplomatic events in Lebanon, there are all of these photographs of him at these conferences, meetings, in these refugee camps. And so we get a really good visual sense of what that part of his career was like, because there are many different sides to Shafiq Handal. And I think for me, the most interesting part is to see, you know, him in this role as a diplomat and seeing how he moves through these spaces in Lebanon. So that's how I started to piece everything together. But it was very interesting because in the Arabic sources, for instance, he's really trying to emphasize how evil the U.S. empire is, but how good American people can be. And so he's making this distinction between the state and the civilian to emphasize we can win hearts and minds in the U.S. because there are people who are boycotting, who are going on hunger strikes to stop U.S. funding to El Salvador. It is the state. It is, you know, whether it's Jimmy Carter, obviously in this period, it's Ronald Reagan, but that is the machine that we have to fight against. And that was really wonderful to see in all of these different source bases, because I also looked at some State Department papers, which were much different in what they had.
Thank you for sharing that, because this sort of addresses a very important issue that not everyone in the U.S. is familiar with, which is that countries like El Salvador, while there is a structured, you know, sort of archival institution within the government that documents these things in Salvadoran history, it's not necessarily as structured as one would see it here in the U.S. So, for example, there is a revolutionary museum in El Salvador in the far corner of the country called Berquin that is not entirely sanctioned by the government because the people over there fighting the good fight have maintained a lot of archival information that doesn't put the government of El Salvador in a positive light. And that also explains the importance of why the family of Shafiq Kando still has a lot of archival information, because that also doesn't shed a positive light on the Salvadoran government, especially in the past and to a certain degree in the present as well. And so this is precisely why we do shows like these, because it points out that not all history is documented the way it should, which is why we have a fantastic guest like Amy Fias on the show today. She's a Salvadoran Costa Rican writer, editor, and historian. Her recent article in NACLA is entitled Brothers in the Resistance. This is the Latino Media Collective here on WPFW 89.3 FM, Washington. We're going to take a quick break right here. Back with more in a minute. Stay tuned.
على ديني على أرض تلاقيني أنا لأهلي أنا فديهم أنا دمي فلسطيني 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 أنا دمي فلسطيني
was Mohammed Asaf, and you're listening to Latino Media Collective here on WPFW 89.3 FM, Washington. Reminding everyone, you can follow us on latinomediacollective.com. You can also follow us on Twitter and then the name at @LMC_show. That is at @LMC_show. And of course, live on WPFWFM.org. That's WPFWFM.org. Once again, this is Oscar Fernandez, and we're speaking about the political life and legacy of Shafiq Handel, a Salvadoran of Palestinian descent, with Amy Fias, who's a Salvadoran Costa Rican writer, editor, and historian. Her recent article in NACLA is entitled Brothers in the Resistance. So, as an example sort of how very little changes in terms of institutional racism and xenophobia, I have a clip here of former U.S. President Ronald Reagan from his 1983 joint session address with Congress. And this sort of gives us a snapshot to the fear and paranoia the U.S. had to revolutionary movements in Central America. So let's take a listen.
Too many have thought of Central America as just that place way down below Mexico that can't possibly constitute a threat to our well-being. And that's why I've asked for this session. Central America's problems do directly affect the security and the well-being of our own people. And Central America is much closer to the United States than many of the world trouble spots that concern us. So, we work to restore our own economy. We cannot afford to lose sight of our neighbors to the south. El Salvador is nearer to Texas than Texas is to Massachusetts. Nicaragua is just as close to Miami, San Antonio, San Diego, and Tucson as those cities are to Washington, where we're gathered tonight. But nearness on the map doesn't even begin to tell the strategic importance of Central America, bordering as it does in the Caribbean, our lifeline to the outside world. Two-thirds of all our foreign trade and petroleum pass through the Panama Canal and the Caribbean. In a European crisis, at least half of our supplies for NATO would go through these areas by sea. It's well to remember that in early 1942, a handful of Hitler submarines sank more tonnage there than in all of the Atlantic Ocean. And they did this without a single naval base anywhere in the area. And today the situation is different. Cuba is host to a Soviet combat brigade, a submarine base capable of servicing Soviet submarines and military air bases visited regularly by Soviet military aircraft. Because of its importance, the Caribbean basin is a magnet for adventurism.
So that was Ronald Reagan in 1983 discussing Central America, I guess sort of as a region of gullible Neanderthals living in the Dark Ages who are susceptible to what he alluded to there, which was Nazism, among other things. Obviously, there's a lot to unpack there, but I want to know if you could give us a few examples in your article of the U.S. government's presumptions of both Salvadorans and Palestinians as terrorists during this time period, because it kind of shows how very little has changed in the last 40 years and how the State Department would keep tabs on somebody like Shafiq Hando during this time. He was just one person, but because he had this connection to two regions, it was enough for the State Department to like keep tabs on him, which was, again, incredible to read that in your article.
Exactly. And as you mentioned, Oscar, I think the reason Shafiq Handal becomes such a person of interest is because he's not just a Salvadoran communist. He has these ties by virtue of his ethnicity or his background that make him sort of the prime suspect, if you think about it. And I have to also emphasize, this was happening in El Salvador as well. There are these images I have back of this, you know, Palestine Planet Bethlehem archive, where there's a wanted poster for Shafiq Handal, and it's because he's a communist. But below it says it's because he's Turco, which at the time was a term used for people from the Middle East. And I think, this is a hemispheric phenomenon, but certainly once Ronald Reagan comes into office, they are tracking his movements by the minute. They know everywhere that he's going. And this is something that everyone can access now via declassified documentation and is available at various different online, but also physical archives in the US. But you can see how closely they were following all of his activities, especially in the Middle East. They didn't even pay that much attention when he was like in Eastern Europe or when he was in Latin America. They kind of assumed that, you know, he would be there. It's kind of the obvious for a communist. But once he goes and starts talking to Yasser Arafat, that's when I started to notice the media, particularly the corporate media in the United States, starts to latch onto that and say, well, does this mean that an Arab Salvadoran is now recruiting Arabs into this communist cause and they're going to come through the border? And so there's this kind of fanciful imagining of these kinds of people as threats, but also as terrorists. That's the implicit assumption in a lot of these documents.
Yeah, allow me to take this moment right here to address the term Turku here, because it is a derogatory term, as you mentioned. But unfortunately, people are still using it in Spanish-speaking media even today. I remember watching a soccer game, and there was a player of Palestinian descent, although he's Latino from Argentina. The announcers were using the term Turco. And again, it's kind of shocking that, you know, Spanish-speaking media, certain sectors of it are still using it, but I digress. But the term Turco also refers to the fact that a lot of the Palestinian diaspora in Latin America was developed in the late 1800s, early 1900s, before what is referred to as the Nakba even happened. And so that gives us sort of a more nuanced understanding of this particular community, not only in El Salvador, but all of Latin America, and why there has been an equal amount of right-wing people of Palestinian descent as they are of leftist Palestinian descent, like Shafiq Kandel. And so this sort of leads me to a very important question here, which is how this article that you wrote about Shafiq Kandel, which is one of the few, if not probably the only one in English right now, how is it tied to, I guess, recent events in El Salvador, or why is it relevant to El Salvador? Because for me, as I mentioned earlier, we are living in a moment of anti-history in El Salvador. Well, there is very few to little discussion to the past and why things that are happening right now are running parallel to what we saw 40 years ago or even a century ago in El Salvador. So can you fit your article into the current context of El Salvador? I know it's a lot, but it's worth mentioning for the fact that there is now a generation of Salvadorans in the country that don't know who this man is, which is stunning to me.
These are all excellent points. And if I may, I think that Kandel, not just for me, but I think as a scholar, as a Salvadoreña, as someone very sympathetic to these kinds of politics, I find him as a voice of moral clarity in his period, but also someone with a prophetic voice for his time and for ours. And so to answer your question about, I would interpret your question too as like, what can Shafiq Kandel say to us today? If he was alive, what might he suggest? And I think we can assume a couple things based on how he had, you know, his very long career. We can take some of that wisdom and apply it for the current context. And so firstly, I think one of the things that he recognized was that the struggle of working class peoples, of indigenous peoples, of disenfranchised peoples is an international and collective one. And it is against material conditions and hegemonic consolidations of power. And so whether that's in the context of El Salvador right now, that is going through a wave of authoritarianism, whether it's the erosion of democratic institutions, the rule of law, the introduction of mano dura policies, no checks and balances, I think that Shafiq Kandel would look at that and say, it is about this coalition building, and it's also about thinking internationally and thinking collectively against what we are facing here, right? Because if we think about it, who are Nayib Bukele's associates, right? And who is he looking to in the north as allies who are going to support his policies and bolster his power? And that's crucial, I think. Then secondly, I think something Shafiq Kandel did very well was point out that we have camaraderie with people of common ethnicity and common heritage, common background. But he resists what I think we would call today identity politics. Not that those things are not important, they're crucial. But what he does with his Palestinianness, I think, is beautiful, because he says, I am Palestinian and I support the Palestinian cause. But even if I were not any of those things, I would still support Palestine. And I think that liberation for Palestine and liberation for El Salvador are the same, right? That we are all looking to overthrow oppression. And it's worth mentioning that Shafiq Handal was an unusual communist in that he supported nonviolent, non-armed approaches to politics and really believed at first that electoral politics was the way to institute change and to resist military dictatorship. And then he says, you know, I've tried this twice and there are fraudulent elections in El Salvador in the 70s. And he said, all right, let's do this FMLN project, right? Because prior to that point, he's just the leader of the Communist Party. Then he becomes one of the major figures that brings about this coalition of five leftist groups into the FMLN and says, we really have to resist in a material way. And so I think all of that is to say there are multiple strategies that he used and was very, I think, adept at being very humane and very, again, having this moral clarity with how to deal with injustice, how to face it and how to fight it, that I find very empowering.
It is empowering. And this is one of the things that compelled me back in 2004 when I was still interning on WPFW to do a whole report on the 2004 presidential elections in El Salvador, because at that time, Shafiq Handal was running for president under the banner of the FMLN. And one of the reasons I made that my first report for WPFW, because it was very open at the time that there were a lot of U.S. officials. This was during the George W. Bush administration. There were a lot of officials that were recycled from the 1980s who had joined the Bush administration, and they were doing all sorts of things to threaten the Salvadoran people if Shafiq Handal got elected as president during that time. And what is stunning to me when I read your article, and please correct me if I'm wrong here, but was Nayib Bukele, the current president of El Salvador, was he working for the FMLN campaign during that time? Because I thought I did my research 21 years ago when that initial story came out. I never saw his name pop up ever. I had to go back to my notes from 21 years ago to see this, but please clarify this for me, because this is one of those things where I had to do like a double take. I'm like, what?
So I did the double take as well. I mean, Nayib Bukele's trajectory on its own is very fascinating as a scholar, not necessarily as a Salvadoreña, knowing what we know now. But that fact of his working in this particular campaign came from my editor at NACLA. And I was really shocked to see that as well, because I knew obviously that he had been affiliated with the party up until he gets kicked out and wants to, you know, freelance his own first presidential run. So yeah, that was a receipt from my editors at NACLA. Shout out to them. They were amazing.
Incredible. I'm still thinking to myself, how is that possible that I missed that? But again, I digress, but it's still a reason why your article is so stunning. And I'll just say right now that we are going to create a link to your article on our Twitter account so people can learn more about this amazing story of somebody who I feel that's been overlooked in history. Now, I'm sort of non-linear here right now, but I want to go back now to 1989 to a protest that you mentioned that took place in San Francisco against U.S. involvement in El Salvador. And this is important to note that there was a lot of protest during that time in the 80s with regard to U.S. support for the military dictatorship in El Salvador, in much the same way as we see students today protesting U.S. support for Israel during its siege on Gaza. So I wonder if you could tell us about this particular protest and how people of Arab descent at the grassroots level made that connection that we made during the course of this conversation with regards to solidarity and understanding that while the Middle East and Central America may be half the world away, the parallels with regards to resistance and who is creating the marginalization of both regions during this time.
Thank you for that reference. This is really important for me, both in the article and personally, to highlight the beautiful things that can come from really horrific events and war. So in 1989, this is, again, we're at the toward the end, right, of the civil wars in El Salvador and toward the end of the civil war in Lebanon. And so a lot of horrific things have happened. And what that has done, as we all know, is create huge diasporas in the United States where, you know, Lebanese people have been coming to the U.S. for many generations. But Salvadoreños, this is really the first major way due to the war. And so you have these diaspora communities interacting and finding common cause in the heartland of empire, right? And this protest is one of many protests, but it's where Eten Adnan, which is a very famous artist here in Lebanon, she's Lebanese, she becomes very international, very world-renowned, but she reads this poem that she writes. And I encourage everyone to read it because she reflects on the experience of the horrors of the Lebanese Civil War, but sees that in what happened in Central America. Because she mentions El Salvador over and over again, but she also makes references to Nicaragua. And I think what happens in this really beautiful poem is that she's saying, like, once again, that our struggles are linked, that we have common cause together. And we have to remember, too, that these civil wars were documented. Now, we talk about history, and we can talk more about that or reflect on that. But something that's really important is a lot of these struggles, a lot of this fighting, a lot of this violence is being televised, right? And so people have access to it. People are seeing the visceral reality of what that looks like and can say, actually, that looks like Beirut. Actually, that looks like San Salvador. Actually, right? And so she is seeing the horrors that had happened in these different places and said, we really have to elevate the martyrs, the heroes. And she talks about this, the room for the anonymous heroes of the streets of El Salvador, which is so poignant because we think about not just the resistance fighters, but the everyday civilians that died in resistance. She is trying to emphasize their memory. And I think it's back to what you were saying. It is in remembering and resisting forgetting that these solidarities also play a role. So it's a fight for justice, but it's also an unwillingness to forget these brave people and who's at fault for bringing all of this violence.
We have about a few minutes left here, and I want to ask you, what else do you hope people take from the story of this person who has, by and large, has been forgotten, not only in Salvadoran history, but Central American history as well? You know, when I do these shows, I've come across over the years a lot of figures that deserve more attention with regards to Central American history. Not only Oscar Romero, but also Prudencia Ayala, who was the first woman to run for the head of state in all of Latin America, and Jose Simeon Cañas, who was an abolitionist from El Salvador, which again reminds us that there was an Afro-descendant community in El Salvador, in spite of what the history books may tell us with regards to Central American history. Where would you put Shafiq Kando there? Would you put him in that same category? What else do you hope people take from this article, from a historical figure that deserves more attention than he has? It's been almost 20 years now since he passed away, but right now is a better time than any to look back on this history.
Thank you for this invitation to reflect on Handel's legacy. And as I mentioned earlier, I feel that there are so many lessons that we can learn from what was a very long career in public service and political mobilization. How do I see his position, particularly now that generations, a newer generation might not remember, or he's not as highlighted? Because I certainly think he's not one of, you know, the figures that you think of when you think of El Salvador, unfortunately. I believe what Shafiq Handal has to teach us is that there is no situation that is beyond action. And I think in our current moment, both, you know, in the United States and globally, there is this real sense of anxiety over the rise of the right, of the rise of fascism, of the seemingly disintegration of leftist coalitions, at least on an electoral level. And I think what Shafiq Handal has to offer, that feeling, that anxiety or that despair, is to say there's always something to fight for, because he was in a desperate position when he went to Lebanon in 1981, and so were others, and things got worse. But I think that the fight is still worth fighting, is what I think he would say. And I think that is something that should stay with us and should motivate us and should keep us building communities with people in our immediate community and beyond our borders, because that's the kind of future that we should be imagining, to have a radical imagination.
You know, it just dawned on me right now that perhaps a good way, or perhaps a loose way, for Americans who may not be familiar with Salvadoran history to better understand who Shafiq Handal was, if we were to look at Oscar Romero sort of as a Martin Luther King type of character with regards to Salvadoran history, then maybe we could see Shafiq Handal sort of in the Malcolm X vein, in order for Americans to understand what we've been talking about here. And it's those type of people in history that are the most exciting to look into, the most compelling, and the one that could teach us quite a lot with regards to recent events. And this is precisely why we want to have you on the show today. And again, this has been like a full circle moment for me to go back on a story that I did 21 years ago and to see it come out in such great detail as you did in your article. So with that said, we've been speaking with Amy Fayas, who's a Salvadoran Costa Rican writer, editor, and historian. Her recent article in NACLA is entitled Brothers in the Resistance, and we're going to create a link to her article on our Twitter account. But Amy Fayas, it's been a pleasure and an honor. Thank you for being on the show with us.
Thank you so much. The pleasure is all mine.
Absolutely. You got it. And with that said, that is it for today's show. We want to remind everyone, you can follow us on latinomediacollector.com. You can also follow us on Twitter under the name @LMC_show. And of course, live on WPFWFM.org. Once again, this is Oscar Fernandez saying thank you very much, everyone, for listening to the show. That's it for today's show. Adios. Nos vemos. Ciao. We'll be right back.
WPFW News in Washington and WBAI in New York. I'm Sue Goodwin. Here are some headlines. The clock is ticking on Capitol Hill as the Senate prepares to vote on legislation passed earlier this week by the House that will fund the government through September. Senators must approve the bill by midnight tonight or face a government shutdown. Republicans need to secure 8 Democratic votes in the Senate to reach the 60 votes needed to overcome a filibuster. Senate Democratic leader Chuck Schumer made a sudden decision to break with his party and plans to vote for the Republican-written bill. Speaking on the Senate floor yesterday, he explained why, even as he called the Republican bill a terrible option. Quote, "It doesn't address far too many of the country's needs, but I believe allowing Donald Trump to take even much more power in a government shutdown is a far worse option." Close quote. Schumer's decision has sparked outrage among some members of his party. Representative Nancy Pelosi of California today issued this blistering statement, quote, "Donald Trump and Elon Musk have offered the Congress a false choice between a government shutdown or a blank check that makes a devastating assault on the well-being of working families across America. Let's be clear. Neither is a good option for the American people, but this false choice that some are buying instead of fighting is unacceptable." Close quote. In more news, two judges yesterday ordered federal agencies to reinstate tens of thousands of workers with probationary status who had been fired as part of the Trump administration's effort to rapidly shrink the federal workforce. Both judges concluded that the Trump administration used false allegations of performance issues as a pretext to justify the large-scale firings. In his ruling, U.S. District Judge William Alsup in San Francisco ordered 6 federal agencies to reinstate probationary employees who were fired last month while stating, quote, "That should not have been done in our country. It was a sham in order to avoid statutory requirements." Close quote. In a more sweeping order, Judge James Breeder of Maryland District Court said layoffs of probationary workers across 18 agencies were conducted without proper notice. Speaking after the first ruling, White House Press Secretary Karoline Leavitt said the power to hire and fire federal workers does rest with the president and, quote, "Singular district court judges cannot abuse the power of the entire judiciary to thwart the president's agenda," close quote. She added, the Trump administration will immediately fight back against what she called an absurd and unconstitutional order. And in more news, the Trump administration asked the Supreme Court yesterday to overturn lower court orders blocking the president's day one executive order attempting to end birthright citizenship. The request comes after 3 federal appeals courts blocked the administration from moving ahead on the order. The Trump administration is not yet asking the judges to rule on the constitutionality of Trump's order, but instead is seeking to limit the lower ruling's nationwide impact. The 14th Amendment, ratified after the Civil War, granted birthright citizenship as a way to guarantee citizenship to newly freed slaves. The Supreme Court in 1898 affirmed birthright citizenship for children born in